Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. Hi everyone, we're back for episode 2 of Prophecy Radio. My name is Karen and I'm joined by...
Kristen. Hello everyone.
Hi. So we have another jam-packed episode this week. I really didn't think that this episode was going to be this big, and then I feel like just everything happened. So we have a lot to get through. Hopefully you guys enjoyed episode 1, and if you didn't, you're here for episode 2. Thank you for sticking around. We have a lot more to come, and yeah... Just thank you so much. This has been so exciting already. So I'm going to get you guys up to speed on all of the news that has been coming out. And I'm not joking. There was a ton of stuff. It's so much. But we're going to speed through it. Just to make sure you guys know everything that's going on with Rick Riordan and everything he's involved with, because it's a lot these days.
Rick cannot be contained, is basically what I'm getting, because we really thought there'd be less news this time. Since last time was kind of like a catch-up, like, okay, here's everything we know, let's get, you know, to where we are now, and then we'll go from here. And then I'm looking at the list of news updates, and I'm like, holy cow! So yeah, there's so much news.
Yeah. So the first thing, and the biggest thing, and this does kind of change stuff for us, is that the Daughter of the Deep release date has been moved from October 5th to October 26th. Now, this is due to COVID-related supply chain issues. Basically, they couldn't print like the books in time, so it had to be moved back a couple of weeks. This is going to change our release order from what I said in the first episode. Rick's already made a liar out of me, so sorry about that.
And just a random note, this is kind of book industry-wide, this whole supply chain thing. It's not just Rick's publisher or his printer or whatever. So if you're looking to get books for people for Christmas or any other holidays, like winter holidays, get them soon, because what they have in stock now is like what they're going to have pretty much, because it's becoming harder and harder to get their hands on ink and paper. And it's insane that this is a thing we're worried about, but it is. So just a heads up in case you're already thinking about presents. So
yeah, I mean, I'm not, because I'm only thinking about Halloween right now.
Christmas.
Yeah, but that's fair, and that's a really good point. So, again, Daughter of the Deep will not be released on October 5th. It will be released on October 26th. Our review of Daughter of the Deep, we're going to do it for our fourth episode now instead of our third episode, and that will probably come out October 25th. It will be spoiler-free, so don't worry about that if you haven't read it yet or anything. It's just going to be like our feelings about the book and how excited we are and what we liked about it and that sort of thing. So for episode 3, we're going to basically just switch the two episodes, and we're going to talk about Rick Riordan Presents and some of the series that I've enjoyed so far. And I think that's a good transition anyway, going from Cursed Carnival into Rick Riordan Presents. So I think it'll work out in the long run.
Agreed. Yes.
Rick and his team also really wanted to make sure that if you do get your book early, please don't post spoilers anywhere, because people around the world are going to be getting it on different dates. And if you're lucky enough to grab a copy on or around October 5th or even before the October 26th release date, please don't post spoilers and ruin it for other people. So that's just a really important thing to keep in mind.
Especially since this is a whole new property for Rick. Like, we know this is kind of like a standalone book, correct? Yeah.
Correct.
So, like, it's totally new. Like, it's not like anything is basically going to be a spoiler. So, yeah, keep the details to yourself until others have had a chance to read it. There will be plenty of time and space to talk, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. So, next order of business, and this was really exciting for me, is we get some new cover reveals. The first one is, and by the way, you can find this on readriordan.com. Again, we'll have all of our links and resources in the show notes, so you'll be able to go to those pages yourself. But if you do go there, you will see that 3 books have now gotten cover reveals. The first one is The Last Fallen Moon by Gracie Kim. This is Gifted Clan's book 2. So this is the sequel to The Last Fallen Star. And this book will be out June 7th, 2022, but it has a really cool cover, and it it looks awesome. I'm really excited for it. The next one is Paula Santiago and the Sanctuary of Shadows by Taylor K. Mejia. This is Paula Santiago Book 3, the final book in the trilogy, which will be out August 2nd, 2022. This cover is a little creepy. There's a shadowy, like, Paula in the background that kind of freaks me out if I look at it too long. So, another great cover. All of these covers, by the way, have been outstanding. And then the third one that got a cover this week was Tristan Strong Punches a Hole in the Sky, the graphic novel. This was, you know, the story is obviously by Kwame Mbalia, and it was adapted by Robert Venditti and illustrated by Olivia Stevens. This is out August 9th, 2022. So all of these are kind of late next year, mid to late next year, but exciting to get covers, and the graphic novel cover looks really cool and dynamic, so I'm excited about that. Okay, so another exciting piece of news. I'm telling you, there was just like so much this week. This one really surprised me. So, City of the Plague God by Sarwat Chadha, which is Mesopotamian mythology. This book was a standalone novel, and I thought it was it, like, one and done, it was over with, that's all we were gonna get. Well, technically, we are gonna get another book. It will have a sequel called Rise of the Chaos Goddess coming in spring 2023. And how amazing is that title? Isn't that so exciting?
Yeah, like, that sounds intense, and I'm like, okay, Chaos Goddess, all right, I'm on board with this.
Yeah. So, like I said, this is based on Mesopotamian mythology, and according to the synopsis, it's about a boy who finds the Tablet of Destinies and uses it to bring back his lost brother, but soon finds tampering with fate can have terrifying consequences. I have not read City of the Plague God, so I don't really have any idea of what this could be about or anything. And when they said Tablet of Destinies, I was picturing, like, an electronic tablet, not, like, a tablet, like, out of stone. I don't know if that's the kind of world that, like, he's built or anything, but
My brain went to the Tablet of Achman-Ra from Night at the Museum. Like, that's where my brain went. I was like, oh.
Honestly, you're probably closer than I am. I'm not sure it's an electronic tablet.
I think that's fantastic. It should be an iPad, and that would, like that would be hilarious. You know, that would be the thing Rick would do. Like, if he called, you know, if it called for a tablet in one of his stories, like, rather than it being, like, a tablet of stone, which is what you would assume with all these mythologies, it would be, like, a Samsung whatchamacallit or whatever. Like, that it's totally something Rick would do. So that's
probably
funny.
Why I thought of it that way.
Yeah.
And on Twitter, Sarwat says, we are going full epic with this one. So I'm not really sure what that means, but it sounds exciting.
I mean, yeah.
Okay, another quick note, Tower of Nero, which is the last book in the Trials of Apollo series, that is now in paperback. So if you have like a paperback collection of those books, definitely grab that one because it's pretty great. Both Daughter of the Deep and Cursed Carnival and Other Calamities are number one bestsellers on Amazon. Are we surprised?
I mean, not
surprised, but it's still exciting to see that little orange tab there. Yeah. So that's cool.
Oh, yeah.
Reed Riordan also has a spotlight on Tristan Strong's Tandiwe, but beware of spoilers if you haven't read Tristan Strong Keeps Punching. I did not look at this article at all because I haven't read that series yet, but it looked really cool and like they would have some interesting information there. Also, The Nerd Daily has a cool interview with Carlos Hernandez about Sal and Gabby. This article is called Authors in Conversation, Nicole Corner, Stace, and Carlos Hernandez. And he talks about a couple of different things regarding the fact that he gave one of his characters diabetes and that Gabby has like a general anxiety disorder and how important it is for him to bring both of those things to like middle grade readers and stuff like that. It was really cool. And lastly, but definitely not least, Ashley Latimer has been the voice of Rick's Twitter account for a whole year now. I feel like that went by so fast.
It did. I do feel like it's been, I feel like it was just like, you know, yesterday or something that, you know, we were hearing straight from Rick's mouth. Like, it's nice that he has somebody to handle the daily stuff, especially with all the stuff with the TV show. I'm sure the last thing he has time to think about is how many times he's posted, because he wants to stay in touch. So it's so great that he has some help in that arena. But congrats, Ashley. And you're doing a great job.
Awesome job. I said last but not least, but I kind of lied, because we have one other big chunk of news, I suppose, or an update to give you guys. So, Cursed Carnival and Other Calamities had a free virtual event, which I attended in anticipation of the book, and not a whole lot came out of this event. Like, it was just kind of them talking about their process a little bit, and each of the hosts answered some questions, but there were a couple of updates that I thought would be interesting to share. So first and foremost, Carlos Hernandez played the ringmaster to almost all of the authors from the book. So Rick Riordan was there, J.C. Cervantes, Yoon-Ha Lee, Kwame Mbalia, Taylor K. Mejia, Sarwat Chadha, and Gracie Kim. Roshni Chokshi wasn't in attendance, and Rebecca Roanhorse couldn't make it at the last minute, which kind of stunk because I haven't seen much of her online, like, just personally. I'm not saying she's not there. I just, you know, she's a new author for me, and I was really interested to hearing from her, but that's okay. Maybe next time. So here are a few things that I learned. From Rick, he talked about My Life as a Child Outlaw, which is the name of his short story in Cursed Carnival and Other Calamities. It's his interpretation of the boyhood deeds of Finn McCool, which is an Irish, like, folklore story, which I had never heard of before, but he's basically like Robin Hood. And he had to make this story kid-friendly because the original story is very violent, which makes both of us laugh because his story is also very violent, which we will get to later.
So if he toned it down, whoo, boy.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. Another cool thing that he talked about was that he stayed as close to the original Irish as possible. That's why you see so many Irish words in the book, which I loved, and I have a lot more to say on that later, too. And then we also heard from Gracie Kim, and this, I really enjoyed The Last Fallen Star, and her short story was an origin story set before The Last Fallen Star, and it's basically about Riley's kind of mindset going into The Last Fallen Star, which is really cool to see, like, a prequel kind of thing like that. She mentioned trench coats and unicorns in her story, which may tie into Hernandez's Sal and Gabby, and it does. Carlos actually said that there is a through line throughout the short stories, throughout Cursed Carnival, and Sal and Gabby show up in some other places, so that's pretty interesting, and again, more thoughts later. J.C. Cervantes, her story ties into the spinoff, which is coming out, called Throne of Sand in 2022. Where her short story ends is where this first book for Ren starts off. And that's a spinoff to her The Stormrunner books. And then lastly, just kind of a random note, but this is the first time I had seen Sarwat, like, talk and interact with people and anything, and I love him instantly. He's so cool, and I just want to be friends with him. Him, Taylor, Carlos, and Rick apparently all play D&D together for charity, and I have not seen this. I tried to Google it really quick and couldn't really find anything, but let me just tell you, the four of them together, I don't know if anybody else was there, but definitely those four, chaos. Like, absolute chaos. I can't imagine how insane that probably was.
I mean, it's always funny to me, like, when you put writers in a room, because they're all somewhat creative people and their brains are always running, I feel like. So, especially with, like, mythology-based stories and stories intended for middle grade, like, I feel like they have to be a little crazy.
Yeah, definitely.
So putting them all in one room to play D&D is gotta be an adventure.
And Yoon was really funny, too. He's, like, the one who's a little bit more stone-faced than the rest of them. But all of them together was just, they kind of did it in two groups. And this group was the second one. And there was just a total, like, shift in energy. And you could tell that these guys are, like, actually friends and they talk and stuff. And I just, I love seeing that out of the Rick Riordan Presents imprint, where you can tell that they get along really well and they're friends and they talk all the time and they have a lot of respect, not only for Rick, but also for each other. Like, I live for that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So much fun. Oh.
Okay. I feel like I did that, like, really fast.
You
that
did.
We just sped through that, but I feel like that's okay because we have a lot more to talk about. I'm just going to rein it in a little bit, give this the time that it's due. But next, we're going to be talking about the Cursed Carnival and other calamities. There's a lot going on here, okay? So I just want to say really quickly all of the authors that are involved with this short story. So, of course, we have Rick Riordan, but joining him, there are 9 other stories here by Carlos Hernandez, Roshni Chokshi, J.C. Cervantes, Yoon-Ha Lee, Kwame Mbalia, Rebecca Roanhorse, Taylor K. Mejia, Sarwat Chadha, and Gracie Kim. A lot going on. The book's like 400-some pages. It's pretty big. Some of these stories are a little hefty.
I was going to say, some of the stories were a lot longer than I expected them to be, which is kind of cool, you know, but it's also like, if you're looking for it to take you like 10 or 15 minutes, you may want to block out like a half an hour to an hour because these stories do have a lot in them. They're kind of dense. And if you have not read these books, we'll get to more of this in a minute. It can be kind of hard. It might take you a minute to read through. They may be for middle schoolers, but I swear, like, it's a lot. You have to, you know, really get into the mythology and the story and, you know, so. But they're really good fun. The ones that I read, for sure, were good fun. That's for sure.
That's awesome. This will be a spoiler-free review, by the way. It's more about our feelings and just highlights of the stories, what we liked about them and that sort of thing. You can read my review of the entire book on Hypeable.com. Again, I'll link to that in the show notes. And basically how we split this up was we both read Rick's story, and I took the stories from the 5 authors that I've read previously. So I've actually read, you know, all of their books that are out right now. And Kristen took the other half, so the half that I haven't read, and she hasn't read any of the Rick Riordan Presents books yet. So you kind of get a little bit of both. You get somebody who's a fan of the series, who's reading these stories with knowledge of the universe that these writers have built, and you've also got somebody who went in with no knowledge and, you know, tried to make her way through, and we'll figure out if it worked or not.
So this will be a really good review for people who have read some of these or wants to know how it, you know, how these stories match up with the books that they've already read for authors that they've read. Or if you've read absolutely nothing and you were just going to pick this up, I can let you know how that went too. Yeah,
exactly. So the first order of business before we get into the individual stories is the introduction, which is titled Welcome to the Multiverse Mansion. And I got really excited when I read this because I've previously talked about how I think that the stories from the Rick Riordan Presents imprint actually exist in Rick's world that he's built, like in the Percy Jackson world. I wrote an article about this on Hypeable quite a few years ago after I read the first Aru Shah book, Aru Shah and the End of Time, because there was a little hint in there that maybe she could, like, go visit Percy Jackson's universe. And I was like, what? Like, my mind, it was like, you know, like, my mind exploded, and I was so excited. And when Rick does the introduction, he talks about how each door in the mansion leads to another universe, and each universe is one of the books that's already out, and of course, like, there are a lot of doors in a mansion, so as more books come out, we get more doors to more universes.
And more authors.
Yes.
Which is, I'm sure, always a thing that could, yeah.
So, even if they don't technically take place in the same universe, there are ways to travel to each one, like, in canon of the books that we have so far. Which is so cool. Like, this is, you know, we talked about this last week as fans of Marvel. I live for this kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that goes with just about any, like, major fandom. Like, it's so much fun to know that, like, an author's previous work does kind of, you know, it does attach itself. Like, when we read Percy and we read the Heroes of Olympus, like, we read the first 2 series, and then we got something completely different from him with Magnus, and I think we all were kind of like, how is this gonna, like, is it gonna connect? Because the first two were obviously a continuation. And, like, getting that loose connection through Annabeth was a way to, like, know for sure that, yes, there is a link, but, like, they are separate stories. But, like, if Rick someday wanted to do, like, a team-up book or something.
Don't get me started. This is my dream. This
Percy and dream. Magnus and, oh, yeah, just all of them all in one place. Like, yeah, that would be really crazy. It would basically be the Rick Riordan, like, cinematic universe. Like, he just, like, we'll just do an MCU thing, but for all of Rick's characters. Like, that could be insane and lots of fun.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a tangent, but like you're saying with like Magnus and stuff, and with the Kane Chronicles, like we got the short story crossover, which was really cool. But we already know he can handle a huge team up from different series with the Heroes of Olympus books. He's pretty good at like showcasing certain characters in each book and giving everyone their due. I'm just saying, if you wanted to do a giant team up, it would be possible. And Cursed Carnival is the closest I think that we'll get to a Rick Riordan Presents team up, because I mean, I would die if somehow they were able to get, you know, like Paula Santiago and Aru Shah and Riley O and like all of those in the same story. Like, yes, please, but that's a lot. It takes a lot of communication and coordination, and they have a lot of other stuff going on right now, so maybe that's dreaming a little bit.
You never know. We won't close the door on the possibility.
Yes. Was that a reference to the mansion? Because that was good.
I mean, maybe on purpose, maybe not.
You'll never know. Okay, so Kristen's going to kick us off here with the stories that she read. And again, she went in with no prior knowledge of any of these stories. So let's get an idea of how you felt about the stories that you read in Cursed Carnival and Other Calamities.
Okay, so first of all, I need to say that I did not read these in the order that they're in the book, which may be a problem all in itself. Like, maybe I should have just read them since I was reading the authors that Karen hadn't read. They didn't go in order of that. So, like, I don't know. It just kind of threw me off. And I'm like, maybe I should have read these in the prescribed order. But I read Rick's first, which is the last one in the book. And then I just kind of went backwards. And so I think that may have been weird. Anyway, just always nice to read a book in order. Can't hurt, you know? Yeah. I'm sure with these, they don't all connect or, like, you know, it's not a huge deal, but I feel like it may have thrown me off just a little. And so, just something I wanted to throw out there. But my biggest takeaway from this is, having not read any of these authors or any of these books of their original stories yet, it was mythology overload. trying to keep up with all the different cultural traditions and the mythologies that come with them and like all of that, I was lost on some of these, where I was reading it and trying to keep up and know what happened, and having the crutch of not like having read the story to lean on, I was really lost for some of these. Still tried to, you know, get through them and have fun with them, and they're still fun. Like, the writing is still a lot of fun and a good time, but so yeah, some of these weren't quite as much my favorite, but I still had a good time with them. And everybody's different. Everybody reads different stuff. So just because I didn't necessarily get into this short story doesn't mean that I wouldn't get into the books, or that it might not be exactly what you're looking for. So keep that in mind. The first one I read was The Gum Baby Files by Kwame Mbalia. And this is the author of Tristan Strong, which is a good thing for me to know. Because, like, the stories don't necessarily tell you, like, which author wrote which book. And so, like, it just, yeah, it's a little confusing. It's a little confusing if you haven't read them. The whole gum baby thing really kind of had me confused. So if you have not read Tristan Strong, I'm just going to recommend right now that you maybe hold off reading The Gum Baby Files until you've read the other books, because I'm assuming that it'll make a heck of a lot more sense if you've read the stories.
This is probably the point where I should tell you that people that like fans are crazy about Gumbaby. Like, I mean, I see stuff on Twitter about Rick stuff all the time, obviously. Second, Gumbaby. Like, I'm not kidding. Like, people talk about Gumbaby all the time. I have a little bit of knowledge because I think I read the first chapter of Tristan or maybe like the first two. So I kind of remember Gumbaby's introduction, but not a lot. But yeah, Gumbaby is an interesting character. I'll just say that. But people love her.
I mean, and I'm not trying to spoil anything, so I'm keeping this very vague, but I was just very confused because when someone is introduced as Gumbaby, it gives you expectations. And then whole sentences are told from this character's point of view, and then seconds later, you get exactly what you're expecting to get earlier, and so it leaves you very, very confused. But ultimately, like, I mean, the story was good fun, and from what I was able to understand, it was a good time. But yeah, I would recommend maybe reading a Tristan Strong book at least before tackling this one, just because, yeah, I was a little confused. But still good fun, and, you know, I, as with anything, you know, it's, I recommend it, but probably better enjoyed with a little more experience with the story and the world. The second story I read was Rebecca Roanhorse's story, The Demon Drum. I knew that Rebecca's stories were Native American based, like mythology based. I didn't know that much because I know I've seen the cover of Race to the Sun and like I've heard things about Rebecca. So I knew that it was like Native American mythology based. And yeah, like I love the idea of Ancestor Club, which is a thing that like shows up in the first page of the short story. And I was like, okay, that's really kind of cool. Like, and from what I gathered, this all takes place like on the reservation, which again, like I don't have a lot of experience with that, but it was all very cool to like get into. In this story, the kids in Ancestor Club are attending All Nations Assembly, which is like basically like all the tribes get together and do like fun activities, and like they basically are just like, it's having like it's basically just like a cultural exchange for all of them because every tribe is different and their traditions are different and they do different things, and so like even cultures that don't necessarily have like get-togethers and powwows in their tradition also participate in this. And I thought that was really cool. So, yeah.
And this is one of the other books that's a standalone. So, like, if you're looking for a book to jump into and then read the short story for, this is probably a good one to start with.
Good note. See? Yeah. Didn't know that. Yeah. Thanks for that. Yeah. And the last little note I had definitely is maybe a slight spoiler for the standalone book because I didn't know this, but in the short story, they talk about monster slaying and how one of the main characters from Rebecca Roanhorse's story is kind of attached to that idea. I'm trying really hard not to completely spoil the whole book because I kind of have an idea of what the actual, what, Race to the Sun is actually about because of what happened in the short story. So if you want to read all of these books someday, you will get some spoilers in the short stories. Just it's inevitable. If you're, especially if you're writing not prequels, like some of the stories were prequels, but yeah, like the whole idea of monster slaying and how it's not necessarily just fighting. It's learning to outsmart monsters and learning to trick them. And like, that's kind of cool. You know, like it sounds very familiar. It sounds a lot like Rick and Percy and all of that. So, yeah, I enjoyed that. And just, I'm looking forward to, that's one I think I may pick up soon, especially since it's standalone.
Yeah.
That might be a good one for me to kind of start with as well, because it did sound like a lot of fun, and I liked all the main characters, so that was kind of
cool. Well, if you need to borrow, it's on my bookshelf,
so. Hey! This is also the good thing about, you know,
yeah, living
sharing a bookshelf.
And, yeah. Woohoo!
The third one that I read was Sarwat Shada's The Loneliest Demon. The story was, I think this one might be the most Rick-like for me.
Okay.
Like, the sarcasm and the dry wit of some of the characters in this story was really, really fun. When the story opens, there's, like, I believe the family, like, owns a restaurant. And there's a demon at the back door, like, threatening the main character, the main kid. And the parents are just like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, they're paying no attention to this demon. And they know it's a demon. This story is set in New York. So I'm assuming that Sarwat's books are set in New York. But they're like, not addressing the fact that it's a demon with the New Yorkers who are, like, a thin wall away from them, you know? Like, anytime somebody who isn't in on the secret is around, they, like, pretend it's a cosplayer from, like, Comic-Con. It's really amazing. Funny, right? It's really funny. And I just, it got me. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then they're like, take him outside. Like, they're like, you know. So I will say that got me. I'm definitely hooked on that. And hearing all the fun things about Sarwat from the get together, it just makes me more excited.
He seems like just a funny guy. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I also loved that this demon that you meet is the demon of deformities, which they make some jokes about. I don't think I'm spoiling anything, trust me. There's a lot in that story. But yeah, it's a really good time, and just the jokes were great. So I highly recommend that one. I was not as confused with that one. It came through a little clearer, and maybe it was just all the humor that made me feel like I was part of the joke. It just made me feel like I was in on the joke, and so it was a little easier to follow that one. So highly recommend that one if you want to kind of just pop in, get a taste of what Rick Riordan Presents is all about. Like, I liked The Loneliest Demon quite a bit. And last but never least, J.C. Cervantes' The Cave of Doom. I really, really liked the setting, but this story was, it was about a family that owns, like, a tourism business. Like, they fly people, or they take, like, charter boats, not fly. It's about a family, and they take, like, charter boats to, like, islands. I'm assuming this has to be, like, Caribbean or Florida, or I couldn't exactly tell where it was set. It probably said, but as I said, I was overloaded on mythology, so remembering all the details was a little crazy too. But I really did like the setting. Like, it felt, especially having read one with New York kind of set and some of the other places in the other stories, this just felt like really fun and fresh. Yeah, this one, the mythology kind of jumps out at you because one of the main characters in the story is like a shapeshifter or has the ability to become something non-human is basically what I'm going to say. And it like took me off guard because I obviously didn't know this character was capable of it. And then all of a sudden this character is flying someone on their back and the main human character is like holding onto their feathers. And I'm like, wait, hold on. I had to go back and read that whole chapter again, or the whole paragraph again. But no, it was really, really fun though. It had a little bit of a spooky thing going on at some points, and so that was kind of fun. You know, I like a little spooky. Not a lot of spooky, but a little spooky. But I liked the writing style. I really liked the characters, and this is another one that I think would be a lot of fun. Like, the actual, like, the first book would be fun to get into, so. That's basically my four stories and my impressions. I hope I didn't spoil anything for anybody.
I think that was pretty good. And I actually have read J.C. Cervantes's first book. I just didn't finish the series yet.
Gotcha.
And, yeah, her books are pretty interesting. And I think the book actually hits you very quickly with the mythology, too. Like, it really just, like, boom, you're there. And so, if you like that sort of thing, that might be a good one to jump into.
Nice.
Okay, so now we're going to get into the stories that I read. And again, I've read all of the books from these series, so I feel like, you know, I'm an expert. And I could tell you how I felt about, like, seeing these characters again and stuff. So the first one we're going to talk about is Carlos Hernandez's Calamity Juice. This is the first story in the series, and if I were to make a recommendation, I would say read this one first. Because Carlos had said there's a little bit of a through line in the rest of the book because of this, and I just, in general, think that it's a really good story to get into. Sal and Gabby is a super fun story. It's a duology, and it reminded me how much I loved the tone of Carlos's books. He's very middle grade. It feels a little bit younger than Percy, maybe, but like not in a bad way, like something I very much still enjoyed. It's very silly. It's a science fiction based story. And I really loved the first book that I read. I still have to finish the second one, actually. But this one, these characters are really great. Unicorns, multiple dimensions, doppelgangers. Those are my keywords. If any of those sound interesting, check out this story. It was really good. And I think it's a perfect one to kick off the book.
I mean, I do like a good doppelganger story.
You do.
They're kind of undervalued in the world of supernatural creatures, so that is kind of interesting to me.
Yeah. Suffice it to say, I think that Carlos's books could be vitally important to the idea of a multiverse mansion.
Interesting.
Yes.
What is the title of Carlos's first book?
I knew you were going to ask me that. It's Sal and Gabby Break the Universe.
Okay, that general idea has me thinking Doctor Strange implications, so I'm just going to throw that out there. As someone who knows nothing, that makes me think of, like, Doctor Strange and, you know, how he's capable of things. So I'm assuming that there's a lot of craziness going on in that story.
And his books are just really, really good. I really enjoyed them. Now, I try really hard not to pick favorites because all of them are awesome and they all have different reasons for why they're fantastic. As a personal opinion only and not commenting on the quality of any story, Roshni Chokshi's Aru Shah series is my favorite out of Rick Riordan Presents. I don't know if it's because it was the first one that came out and I just really latched onto it, or if it's because it really reminded me of how much I love Percy Jackson. You know, like, you got this, Aru Shah is like a little bit of a troublemaker and she's kind of sarcastic and she gets into trouble and she's not always the best at what she does, but she tries really hard, and because of her friends, they figure things out, and over the course of the series, she becomes more of a leader. Remind you of anybody? Does it? It should. Roshni Chokshi's short story is Beware the Grove of True Love, and I just love Aru Shah and Minnie and Bryn, and I could spend forever with them. They have such great chemistry, and over the course of the books, like, you can tell they've gotten a lot closer, so it's just really cool to, like, visit them again. I really liked that this story was about the power and the danger of love. I think that, you know, we always hear true love's kiss and, like, you know, true love will bring you back together and stuff. But, like, there's a danger in love as well, and the things that you'll do for love, not always the best reasons, you know, to do that. So I thought it was really a really balanced and interesting story. If you're a fan of Aru Shah, there's going to be some things in here that might make you slightly emotional. Just throwing that out there. But as an aside, Urvashi is a really interesting character. She's like one of the celestial, like, beings. And her last line in the story was ominous.
Ooh.
Yeah. So this takes place, I believe, prior to the fourth book in the series. So I think we have possibly yet to see what's going on with that, or maybe it was about the fourth book. I'm not really sure, but either way, ominous.
Oh, good fun.
Yeah. So next I read Yoon-Ha Lee's story, The Initiation, and this is actually one of the ones that I was most excited about because Dragon Pearl was another one of those books that was supposed to be a standalone novel, and they've kind of expanded it into its own series now.
You know, I think this might be why I have trust issues. All of these books that are supposed to be standalone end up being... No, I'm just kidding. I just think it's funny how it's like one book comes out and it's like, you know, this had a lot of readers and there are a lot of characters and we can do fun things. So I kind of love that all of these, you know, it started out as a standalone, but guess what? We're getting more. Like, that's so cool. I love that.
The sequel to Dragon Pearl is going to be Tiger Honor, and I'm not going to get into what that's about because kind of a spoiler, and I'm not 100% sure I know the details of it. This is definitely the short story, The Initiation. It definitely takes place after the Dragon Pearl. So if you've read Dragon Pearl, you can read this. I also didn't think it was very hard to get into this one. I read Dragon Pearl. I think that actually came out second or third after Arusha, and I think J.C. Cervantes' book as well. So I read this years ago. Like, it's been a while, and it was very easy to remember what had happened. So this might be another easy one to jump into if you're not familiar with the book. The open ending of the initiation definitely makes me want more. Please, please, please give us more. I think that was a lot of fun. It's a really cool story. It's another sci-fi story with Korean mythology, fox spirits.
Ooh.
Yeah, we're, you know, Teen Wolf fans over here, so fox spirits usually get us pretty excited.
Yeah.
But this one had a lot of creatures, dragons, and like a whole bunch of different shapeshifters and people with different powers, goblins and stuff. Like, there's a really interesting mix here that I think is a lot of fun. And I really love this world. It also has really natural and subtle inclusion and representation. There's a non-binary character who goes by they, them in the book, and it just happens. They don't talk about it. Like, it is what it is. And as a middle grade book, especially, this is the kind of stuff that I love seeing. So that was really exciting for me.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. Yeah.
Fourth on the list for me is Taylor K. Mejia's Bruto and the Freaky Flower. This is another one I was really looking forward to. This one takes place in between Paola Santiago books 1 and 2. And if you like Paola and Dante, this is a nice story for you. Especially given the events of book 2. That's all I'm going to say. This was actually the only story to make me tear up because I love Bruto so much. And I know Kristen's like, who's Bruto? Tell me.
Paola, Bruto, Dante. Yeah. They all sound like very cool people.
Well, Bruto's not a people.
See, I'm wrong. I'm already wrong.
Bruto is her dog. And that's all I'm going to say.
I love it already.
Yeah. But it was a really cute story and just a really interesting, like, one-off adventure that I think is also very easy to kind of get into. I love this world as well, and I think that Paola's world is really different from a lot of the others. It's dark and macabre, but, like, in an approachable way, if that makes sense. Like, it's a little spooky sometimes, but it feels like something you can't help but, like, dig a little deeper into.
No wonder you like this.
Yeah. And last, but certainly not least, out of my, you know, non-Rick Riordan authors, I dove into Gracie Kim's My Night at the Gifted Carnival. This takes place prior to The Last Fallen Star, which is the first book in the Gifted Clans series. I'm telling you, keeping track of all this in my head.
I'm impressed because I was lost.
There's so much. Oh my goodness. But this is Korean mythology, and it's basically witches. So I think you would actually really like this story.
She says that because I watch a lot of, like, The Vampire Diaries and the originals and Legacies and, yeah, you know, Nancy Drew. So there's a lot of supernaturals and witches and crazy things.
Yeah. And this mythology and world is really unique and new and interesting to me. It's not something that I have a lot of prior knowledge about. And I think her spin on things is just really cool. So I definitely can't wait to read more. Another reason why I love this series and why I love Gracie Kim is because Gracie loves food and I love food, and she writes enchanted food into the story where you can eat it and you can, like, speak in parcel tongue and stuff. Like, she literally put that in the story. Yeah.
I mean,
how could you not want to read that?
That's cool. I want to eat a donut and, like, spit fire or, yeah, something. Like, that sounds cool.
Oh, man. There is definitely a reference to Sal and Gabby in this story.
Ooh,
100%. So, intrigue. Yes, exactly. And in general, it was just a really cool prequel that gives you not only a better understanding of Riley's mindset at the start of The Last Fallen Star, but a really cool sneak peek into this world and the mythology that she talks about, including some things that we didn't even see in the first book. So it's a cool little background and a cool introduction. Actually, I think this would be a really easy story to jump into if you haven't read The Last Fallen Star yet.
I can see why that, yeah. If this is a prequel, then that's probably a fun way to kind of, you know, dive into that whole thing. That's cool. Yeah. That's very cool.
Okay, so
We made it, guys. Okay.
Yes, we made it.
We put Rick last because, yeah, you know, obviously. It's last in the book, which is.
We did nothing else in order, but this one we decided had to be last.
Yeah.
So we both read this story, obviously, because it's Rick's story. And this one was it's called My Life as a Child Outlaw, and it's based on Irish folklore. I guess it's not like really Irish mythology, this one, but like he's supposed to be writing more Irish mythology stories in the future, we think. There's no confirmation on that, so please don't quote me, but he's got his like master's degree in like Celtic mythology studies, yeah, language, all of that. So,
and just as a general thing, after reading this short story, I want him to write a series about Irish mythology, because while this story doesn't have a lot of like supernatural elements to it, I can see how it wouldn't be hard to weave some supernatural things into this kind of world if he wanted to use this as a jumping off point, which I have no idea if that's in the plans or whatever. But like, it would be easy for him to kind of take it and Rickify it from here.
Rickify it.
I really think it would be easy to Rickify it, because
oh my gosh,
it's a really, I really like the story. I want to say fun, but it's also just, then you think of the violence. We'll get there.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I wanted to just say, yeah, that I think if he was using this as a jumping off point, or maybe it was just an exercise to kind of get his mind in the right place to start writing Irish mythology, like that would be, I can see why this would be a really good starting point.
Yeah. So we did talk a little bit about this before, and like he said during that Cursed Carnival live event, he had to find a way to make it kid friendly. I'm not sure he 100% succeeded. I mean, he definitely made it more kid friendly, I think, but
yes,
guys, there's a lot of violence in this one.
A lot of death.
Yeah, and let's remember the main character is 8 years old.
Yeah.
There's a lot of murder, like not just death, like straight up murder.
And some, and it's murder because it's senseless death.
Yeah.
Like, there are deaths that happen in this story because of things that are going on, but then there's also, like, people that just die, and it's like, why did this character get... Okay, yeah. So, yeah, it's very, very violent.
I think you just kind of roll with it after a few pages, and I will say, like, I mean, I don't really have a good frame of reference for what kids can read and stuff, but, like, I wouldn't say that this isn't something that a kid could read. Like, I think they could, but if you're somebody who tries to be extra sensitive to that, like, yes, there's a lot of murder in this story.
I mean, Hunger Games...
Also murder?
I was gonna say, it might be fairly comparable... Although, maybe more death. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Moving on.
The tone is a lot harsher, I think, is part of that, too. Like, not only is it violent, but, like, the tone. The main character, I'm not sure I liked him very much, but I didn't necessarily dislike him either.
I think that's an interesting thing to kind of get into, because when we first start it, you're being told the story from this young 8-year-old's point of view, basically. And, of course, you immediately start identifying and figuring out how you're going to identify with this 8-year-old. And quickly, you start to learn things about their history and their backstory, and you start to question whether you should be identifying with them. Because there's some twisted things that have happened, not necessarily that this character did, but, like, how this character's history... like, came to be. It's not necessarily, like, a good guy's story, while this kid hasn't necessarily done anything bad either yet. So, it's very complicated. And I'm with you on the, I didn't necessarily know how to feel at first. As the story went on, they grew on me a little. But at first, I was kind of taken aback by what we learned and how quickly we learned it and how I was supposed to feel about it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. The other part to the story is that it's not a modern story, which I thought was pretty interesting and not something we've really seen from Rick, because obviously all of Percy Jackson and his other mythologies take place in the modern day. This is not modern day, and I think it stretched a different muscle for him, something he does very well, by the way, like establishing the world and talking about the different aspects of this character's life. Like I said before, he incorporated a lot of the Irish language in there. And so you're talking about things that, like, we don't use these days because we've grown past that kind of thing. Thanks to industrialization and modernization and all of that. But
yeah,
I think that he did a really, really good job of plopping us down into the middle of this world.
Yeah. I kind of had a little trouble at first trying to decide whether it was, like, set back in older times, and where exactly it was set, because, this isn't really a spoiler, but it's like, you kind of start in the woods, and so many books start in the woods that are modern, but it feels kind of older because there's no electricity, and there's no this, and there's no that. But as, you know, you kind of step out of the immediate, like, where you start the story, like, the setting, the immediate setting of the story, you quickly understand that, yes, this is an old story. Like, this is set back way before modern technology and whatnot. So, yeah, but it did take me a minute to kind of grasp that. But once I did, like, I was on board. It just, you had to kind of think it through.
And you definitely wanted to see what was going to happen next.
Oh, yeah.
Especially with all the violence. And, like, I was like, okay, where's this story going to end? Like, what are we trying to get out of this? And I think that it's definitely a journey. Like, this story takes place over the course of a year, so a lot happens, and you're like, okay, what's going to be the result of these events? And that definitely kept me reading.
One of the things for me that just kind of came out of this, I feel like this gave Rick, like, an opportunity to do what he does so well, especially in kind of adapting mythology that can be very adult to be appropriate for children and to be fun for children. He took a story that was clearly not made for children and made it into that. And in doing so, finds a way to make it funny, because as violent as this is, I laughed out loud at the story a handful of times because of things the main character was saying in his head about people, or things he says out loud to characters that are, like, scary. And I'm like, what are we doing? So I really, really felt like this was kind of maybe Rick at his purest, like his most Rick, because he was taking something that, it, you know, is absolutely scary and big and adult, and did a really good job, I think, of trying to adjust it for kids to be able to enjoy. So I just thought it was really cool.
Yeah. One of my favorite aspects of the book was actually his foster mothers. And I'd love to read a story about his foster mothers working magic, hunting monsters, and killing any man who dare lay a hand on them, as, you know, Rick wrote in the book. Like, I would read that series.
Oh, yes.
Without hesitation.
Yes, please.
So at the end of his story, he puts a glossary of terms in there with pronunciation for the Irish, which I had a ton of fun with. By the way, I was pronouncing all of the Irish wrong, like, so bad. Like, banshee looks like bean sidhe. And yeah, it was nuts. And I would like to apologize to anybody who, you know, speaks this language or anything, because it was very bad in my brain. But I went through every single word in the glossary and said them out loud at the end. And it was just really cool to, like, hear the real pronunciation. Probably won't remember any of them, but it was really cool. And if that's something you're interested in, as, you know, somebody who enjoys languages or writing or anything, like, it's just a really cool thing that he does. And he does that in, like, a lot of his books with the Greek terms and stuff like that.
I will say, especially in, like, movies and TV or whatever, the name Siobhan has always given me a lot of trouble, because when you see it printed, I believe it's an Irish name, and when you see it printed, it's S-I-O-B-H-A-N.
Yes.
And it's always, like, floored me that that's the pronunciation.
That's,
and
how you say that word.
It's Siobhan. Yeah. I never knew, like, the reasoning behind it. And I recently, I forget what show I was watching, but, like, the character kind of explained something about her name to someone who was ignorant of its origin or whatever. And I was like, oh, like, that all makes sense. It was really cool. So this is kind of a bit of that, where he gives you a quick way, you know, looking at the pronunciation, you're like, oh, okay, like, I kind of see, yeah. But that just, that takes me right back to the Siobhan thing, because I used to think it was spelled way different.
Oh, yeah.
And knowing what I do now, I'm like, oh, okay, like, that's, yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah.
I like etymology and exactly. all of that fun stuff. It's very good to,
yeah, we're both very into that. Okay, so that wraps up the Cursed Carnival and Other Calamities for us. I think that was a journey for both of us.
Definitely.
It was a lot of stories. It was a lot of mythology. It was a lot of new things and old things combined for us. But overall, like, obviously we would recommend this book. It was a ton of fun. It's a really good way to see what stories you might latch onto just reading it, you know, at first sight with no knowledge. And then you can go, oh, there's a whole series dedicated to this. Maybe I'll go pick it up. So this was, I think, from a publishing point of view, really smart for them to do, but also for the writers, probably really fun just to do like a short one-off adventure for their characters.
Oh yeah. Whether they did a prequel or a sequel or whatever, I'm sure it was fun to kind of pop back in and tell a short story and get to, like, you know, play with that. If it's a sequel, it may be a launching point for whatever adventure is next for those characters, too. So that's good.
Yeah, exactly. But now we're going to get back to something we know and love quite well, something that we are very used to and doesn't take too much brain power to talk about. And that's our Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief review. This week we are discussing chapters 3 and 4. So, Kristen, why don't you kick us off?
Okay, so chapter 3 of Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief is entitled Grover Unexpectedly Loses His Pants.
Love it already.
Right? All about Grover. Let's just do it. This is now a Grover Appreciation Podcast. No, yeah, I'm just kidding.
We're going to change our name to Grover Radio.
I mean, that fits. Just boom. Right there. Done. No, but I think we should start with our favorite quotes. And this time I will give my favorite first, because I may have jumped in and put this in there, because my favorite quote from the book, nobody actually says it, it's Percy in his mind. He says, "My mother can make me feel good just by walking into the room." And this sums up Sally in so much, like, it made my heart go, oh, Sally Jackson, I love you. Because I do. I really, really, really love Sally. And her introduction is so, like, we find out a lot all in a very short period of time, but we also don't find out a lot.
Yeah.
Like, there's still a lot to learn
you
about
have
Sally.
So many questions.
Yeah. So I was just really excited to get to this chapter, because I love watching Percy and his mom together in this brief introduction. But yeah, so that was my favorite quote. Karen, what was yours?
Mine was also, like, in Percy's head, and this was right at the beginning of the chapter. He goes, "Confession time. I ditched Grover as soon as we got to the bus terminal. I know, it was rude, but he was freaking me out." And it just made me laugh, like,
yeah.
I could just see Percy going, I can't handle this, goodbye.
And it's so Percy to do the opposite of what someone asked him to do, because yeah. Grover literally just told him, like, don't leave without me, and what does he do? Like, that's yeah. exactly what he does, is take off without him. Yeah, no. Perfect. Yep, gotta love it. Okay, so now we will move on to our favorite moments. And for me, it was the blue food explanation. I guess I don't remember. I didn't remember this as well. Like, obviously, okay. The blue food, like, yeah. stuck in my brain. But I don't remember it being, I don't remember it as a way to get back at Gabe. Like, Sally and Percy, it, like, Gabe saying, no, there's no such thing as blue food. And Sally, like, being like, yes, there is. And just implementing blue food into their diet, like, anytime she possibly can. It informs so much of what you know about Sally later on in the books. Mm-hmm. Like, once you kind of get past this first introduction of her. And it just, it was a nice little reminder that, like, there are little things that I probably missed reading this oh, so many years ago now. And it was a nice little reintroduction to why blue foods are important to Percy and Sally. And I love that it's a new little tradition for the two of them to to eat blue food together.
Yeah, this kind of goes hand in hand with my moment, honestly, because my favorite moment, if you could call it that, series of moments, is just Sally Jackson as a single mom. She's such a fantastic character throughout the entire series, and she kind of always stays that way. And it's impossible not to love her, especially once you learn why she's with Gabe. And the blue foods is really a huge part of that, and it's obviously something that the fandom like latches onto and everything. We have an entire article on Hypebull about like natural blue foods in nature and stuff like that as a celebration of Percy Jackson. And I think you and I baked that blue cake that one time, didn't
yes.
I? Yeah, we did that.
Yes.
That was a lot of fun. I think we did that for Percy's birthday one year.
Yep. I believe we did.
Yeah. And it's just, yeah, I think because Sally is such a kind and generous person. Like, as soon as she walks into the room, it's such a gentle presence. You feel so comforted by her. She's such a good mom. And I think that for this to be the one thing that she kind of sticks to Gabe, the one rebellious act that she has, means a lot. Like, she's willing to do so much for Percy and willing to put up with Gabe, as awful, as terrible, as monstrous as he is, but she won't let him get to her 100%. It might be 99% because she's got to do what she got to do, but that 1% she will never move on, and I just got to respect that so much.
It's a mother's sacrifice, but like, she withholds that one little bit of herself and is like, nope.
Yeah.
Like, here's where I draw the line. I'm saving this for, yeah. Like, that's, yeah. I agree with you. Gotta love Sally. Basically, in this chapter, we meet Gabe. We meet Sally. Percy goes home, which we learn is not... He loves being with his mom, but being home is not great because of Gabe, and he hates Gabe, and we all hate Gabe.
Gabe is the worst. He's, like, almost Umbridge-level terrible. Like, I hate him so much.
Yeah, and it doesn't, like, since you don't know why this character is here right now, like, in these chapters, we don't learn why Gabe is a thing and why Sally puts up with him. I just found myself, you know, getting frustrated for her. Like, why is she stuck with this guy? I mean, we've read the stories before, so obviously we know why. But, you know, as of right now, Percy has no idea. And he just thinks that she puts up with Gabe because something about him must be likable, or there must be, you know, there must be a reason, and he doesn't know it and he can't figure it out. So, yeah, basically Gabe's the worst.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot more to do there. But we also see that Sally does find ways to get away and be with Percy and get some time away from Gabe. She makes some sacrifices to do it, but she does what she has to do because she's Sally and she's a total badass. Just throwing that out there. But no, they escape from the house, from the apartment, and they go to a cabin that they've been to many, many times. And I love that they have to, like, clean it out. Like, they talk about, yeah, like, the spiders in the cabinets and, like, you know, like, their first order of business is to give it, like, a top-to-bottom wipe down and, you know, make the living spaces livable.
But they were happy to do it because they were doing it together.
Yeah. And it's tradition, and it's what they do, and they love to do it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, especially since this is kind of an unexpected trip home because he just got kicked out of school.
Yeah.
It's not quite like a planned thing. I kind of love that this all comes together. Like, she's been hopefully planning to get out to the cabin as soon as, you know, she gets a chance to get away with Percy. And I love that it just kind of works out. But yeah, once they're at the cabin and doing their cleaning, it kind of starts getting stormy, and then a certain someone comes knocking at the door.
So, while you were reading this, did you get flashbacks to Harry Potter and Hagrid and the place that the Dursleys take him?
I mean, it's pretty close, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
Only, I mean, and it is a friendly face at the door.
Yes, it is.
It's definitely a friendly face at the door. But yes, Grover comes crashing through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's when we figure out that Grover lost his pants.
Yeah, that is true.
So this would be Percy's first true confrontation with, like, the supernatural world that he's about to...
Like, can't deny it. You know, everyone kind of told him Mrs. Dodds didn't exist and all of that. And, like, I think that was so fast that he was like, I mean, that happened, but, like, what happened? Versus, like, he's staring at Grover and Grover has hooves. Like,
yeah.
You kind of can't just be like, well, I can explain this away kind of thing.
And the him seeing Grover's hooves is how this chapter ends.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well. The other quick thing that I wanted to mention about this chapter was at some point Percy has a dream about a horse and an eagle fighting, which we know is Poseidon and Zeus.
Yes.
And I just, one of the things I really, really love about this series is all of the prophetic and metaphorical dreams that various characters have, because I love analyzing dreams. Like, I, Kristen knows this. I have the craziest dreams in the world. They get really intense and really weird sometimes. And so I love thinking about, okay, why did I dream that? Or, like, what could that mean and stuff like that? And obviously in a book like this, they actually do mean something. They actually can be a prophecy. And I always really like analyzing that and trying to figure out, okay, if this is what the dream is telling this person, then how is that going to, you know, affect something later in the book, or how is this foreshadowing for something that'll happen later in the book?
So, prophecy count, one.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Oh my god, do we need to keep a prophecy count?
I mean, I feel like
we should.
We're called Prophecy Radio. Yeah. There should probably be a prophecy count.
Yeah.
This, I guess, would count as number one then, because... I
mean, it's a dream, and it's definitely about Zeus and Poseidon fighting and, you know, how that could... I think it counts. Yeah.
So prophecy count is number one now.
Awesome.
We'll have to try and keep track of this.
Yeah, I know.
If you think we miss a prophecy or something, feel free to let us know.
Yeah.
We'll get to the contact info at the end of the podcast. Yeah. Don't worry. We will move on now to chapter 4, which is entitled, My Mother Teaches Me Bullfighting.
I mean, again, how could you not just want to figure out what that means?
And Sally, my hero. Okay, so... We're going to get into favorite quotes, and I will start. Mine was from Percy, and he's talking about Grover, and he says, then he groaned food, and I knew there was hope. I mean, food, hope, Grover, Percy, all good things.
Yeah, definitely.
But no, just hilarious.
And my favorite quote actually comes from right, I think, like, the paragraph beforehand, maybe. And it's when... Percy is kind of thinking in his head, even if you are half barnyard animal, you're my best friend and I don't want you to die. And it just, like, again, it just really made me laugh.
I mean, I love it. I love it so much. There's a reason we made a podcast
about it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no. We're going to say that like 20,000 times.
I know, but it just makes me smile. Like, yeah. I love these opening chapters because... Nobody knows anything, and it's really cool.
It's just chaos, and it's so fun to just live in it for a little while.
Yeah. Okay, so favorite moments now. Mine was Grover being mad that Percy thought he was part donkey, and, like, the instruction that it is not a donkey, I am part goat, and that is how this goes, and you will not get that wrong again, basically. Yeah. Which is just hilarious.
I have to say you did kind of steal my favorite moment, because how could that not be your favorite moment?
Oops.
But I did decide on another one, which is actually a little bit more serious than this, and it's Percy defeating the Minotaur on instinct alone. I just think that's so cool and just goes to show how powerful of a demigod he is and how they're hardwired for battle and stuff. We talked about that a little bit with the dyslexia and their brains being hardwired for ancient Greek, and then the ADD, you know, being good for being battle ready and everything. And this just proves that he doesn't really need training to just figure out what to do and go on instinct. And he defeated a Minotaur, and as we'll find out in the next couple of chapters, kind of a big deal.
Yeah, not a small task at all. Okay, so in this chapter, just a really quick kind of summary, they leave the cabin, he's seen Grover's hooves, freaked out, get in the car, drive away, because the Minotaur is bearing down on them and they need to get the heck out of Dodge. So yeah, they start driving and basically quickly the Minotaur is catching up and Sally ditches the vehicle. Like, there, you know, she's,
the vehicle is destroyed.
She safely crashes, I guess, is the safe way, is the thing. Like, she can, you can tell she kind of tried to do it as safely as possible, but like, how do you crash a car safely?
Yeah.
And her whole point was trying to get as close as she could to the only place she knew Percy would be safe, because she's Sally.
Which is?
Camp Half-Blood.
Oh my gosh.
Although I don't think the word is uttered in this chapter.
No, it's not. They call it a summer camp, but they don't say Camp Half-Blood. Probably because Percy would be like, Half-Blood? What does that mean?
Right.
I didn't think I was going to be this excited for her to be like, so there's this camp. And I'm like, ah, I know what that is.
And I will say the worry between, like, Percy and his mom is she's like, you know, I know your dad wants you to go there, but I don't, because it means that I might have to say goodbye to you. And, like, that whole interchange between the two of them kills me because, I mean, we know better.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to think about a parent who, as we know, has sacrificed quite a bit for her son just to keep him alive, is now having to make the ultimate sacrifice for her child, and, ugh, it kills me every time. Like, I didn't cry, but I was close. It's a hard scene for me.
It's a really emotional moment. And I have to say, part of that, too, that I really enjoyed was the pairing we didn't really expect between Sally and Grover, where they might not really know each other, they haven't really talked before, but they're both in the know where Percy isn't, and they're both, their main goal is to protect Percy, and just like how the two of them work together to try to convince Percy that this is really the best thing for him. I really like loved that so much, and I would love to see more Sally and Grover moments.
I mean, more Grover, more Sally.
Yeah.
I'm on board. Rick, get on. No, I'm just kidding.
Spit off.
He's got a busy, busy
yeah.
day, month, year, life. Okay, so the next big event is basically Sally's disappearance being, you know, the Minotaur is attacking and he gets his fist around Sally's neck. And as Percy's watching, his mother, quote unquote, dissolved before my eyes, melting into light, a shimmering golden form, as if she were a holographic projection. A blinding flash, and she was simply gone.
Trauma much?
Yeah. Like, as I don't know if my immediate thing would be she's dead, but she's gone.
She's
like,
gone.
I don't know if she died, but, like, she's clearly not here, and considering he knows nothing, that, oh my god.
Imagine what Percy is going through right now.
Ugh.
He just found out his best friend is half goat.
Yep.
He is looking at a Minotaur for the first time in his life. His mom is possibly sending him away forever, and he doesn't know why. And now she just disappears into golden light. Like, what do you do with all that information?
Right. Like, that's a lot for anyone.
Yeah.
Let alone Percy, who is 12?
Yes.
Years old.
Yeah. 12.
12 years old. Like, he's only 12 years old. I mean, yeah. We talked about the eight-year-old in Rick's other story today. But, like, he's only 12. There's nothing, you know, it's still really young. And, yeah. So this was really intense. But quickly after Sally disappears, we all know that Percy uses his talents to the best of his ability, even though he has no idea what he's doing. And he makes it onto Camp Half-Blood property. And he rolls up to the cabin where we know who who's greeting him. But we hear, "Silence, Annabeth," the man said. "He's still conscious. Bring him inside."
Yeah. Annabeth!
Annabeth!
We love Annabeth here, too.
Yes. I mean, how do you not love any of these guys?
Yeah. The thing that I want to say most about this chapter is that it is so full of suspense and mystery because Percy really doesn't know what's going on. If you're reading this for the first time, you also don't know what's going on. So you're like, what is happening? And it's so full of action. I just, like, it's a really great, fast-paced chapter. But also, and I think this is vitally important to remember for, like, this chapter, this book, this entire series and universe, is that Rick is so good at balancing and blending his tone of voice in these stories, because you have this Minotaur, which is in his underwear.
Yes.
Like literally wearing, like, tidy whiteys. Exactly. Okay.
Which I forgot about and laughed my butt off, I gotta tell ya.
So that in and of itself is just hilarious. But then he makes Percy's mom disappear. Yeah. He's charging Percy. He looks scary. He looks like a Minotaur, which is half bull, half man. Like, it's a terrifying image. And to be like, oh, haha, that's funny. And oh my gosh, somebody might have just died. Like, and to make that work in the same chapter is really difficult to do. And I think this is where Rick is just, like, he's perfected it. And this is the first book in the series. It only gets better from here.
Yeah, it's hard to reconcile the fact that this is the first middle grade novel that Rick wrote, and he's already handling it so well. Like, he has such a specific tone, and it works so well that, you know, it's the master. He's Rick Riordan. Yeah. You know, I'm so glad. But, yeah. No, it's a really good... These were a really good pair of chapters, and I'm glad we paired them together, because it's kind of the whole...
Yeah, the sequence.
Yeah, it's the whole sequence of them running from the cabin, getting out, getting to Camp Half-Blood, and then we'll get to see next time Percy's first glimpses at all the craziness of Camp Half-Blood, so.
It's so funny to think that we're only on chapter 4, and we're already here at Camp Half-Blood, and there's so much more to go. I can't wait.
Yep. And that's pretty much where we leave this one, and we will pick up next time with chapter 5. So, now it's time to give you our contact info, so that if you have any of those prophecy things that you think we need to add to the prophecy count, you know where to reach us at. You can follow us on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast, or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr, where our handle is all the same. It's Prophecy Radio Podcast. So for all three of those, Prophecy Radio Podcast is what you're looking for. Twitter is the only one that's different. You can also email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. If you want to reach out to Karen or I individually, you can do so on Twitter, especially is probably the easiest. You can find her at Karen_Rott and me at Cranzy85. Cranzy is Z-I-E. But all of that will be in the show notes, so don't panic. You can find it there. And if you can find the podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Subjectify Media, I hope you do. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you love it. Feel free to reach out to us in any of the ways. Leave us questions and comments and let us know if there's something you really want to see or hear us do on the podcast. But for now, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.